Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast, we discuss whether or not Labour's right to whip its MPs to vote for the second reading of Article 50.
Whether or not anyone knows what's going on with Northern Ireland and the border.
A noose reveals who her backbencher of the week is. And you ask us, who let the dogs out? So after a court case... However many speeches, two prime speeches.
A million billion speeches in the House of Commons.
Two speeches by the Prime Minister. We are now finally debating whether or not to pull the trigger on Article 50, thus triggering. Wow, we're going to use the word trigger a lot in this episode.
I think the important thing is that this is the second reading of the bill. So there is still a committee stage and then a final vote on it. So this is a kind of interesting interim stage. There won't be the vote on this bit until next week. I read your blog and I watched some of the speeches because I apparently don't have enough hobbies. And I could see a lot of people were making the clip that they were then going to put on their Facebook page about what they reckon about Europe. Or some of the older Brexiteers just looked like they were happy to be out of the house.
So there were some people who just were taking the opportunity to go, who won? I won. Who's the big dog? It was very much Parliament at its worst in the most part, i.e. MPs basically wanting to go, look, I was there, I contributed.
Wasn't it a bit worrying, though, how both Nick Clegg and Ed Miliband looked quite foxy?
So, I don't know. So I have an unpopular opinion, which is that I feel Nick Clegg has got a lot less attractive with his glasses now.
That is the wrong opinion.
I just feel like, you know, without them, he was kind of dreamy and...
Yeah.
You sort of imagined him being kind of... You can imagine him being someone like in a David Hare play or one of those like BBC Two dramas and you're like, oh, I wish I was cerebral enough to be bothered to watch this. But he used to look like that and now he kind of looks like he might be the dad of someone in a cerebral BBC Two drama. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the glasses.
I will take the glasses. But I meant... I wasn't talking about their physical appearance. I was talking about their principled opposition to both Donald Trump's refugee ban early in the week and, of course, Article 50.
Is Ed Miliband voting against triggering Article
50? No, but he was the one who had a backbench debate about the Donald Trump's refugee ban earlier in the week. So he was there. His hair's done... I think of it as the pigeon shit spot, but it's bigger, but I think it suits him.
Well, I think the problem with the dab of grey, as some people would call it, was one, when you're right in the centre of the chamber, the camera was almost like it was designed to draw attention to it. Two, as it's got bigger, he does have wonderful, wonderful hair, the volume on that thing, but onto the, you know, the weighty matter of,
yeah, sorry,
of their speeches, yeah.
Trouble is, that bit about me talking about Nick Clegg's glasses is almost our version of what the MPs were doing, right? Which is that everyone in the whole world would rather do anything but talk about the incredibly grinding minutiae of Brexit. So there's been the Exiting the EU Select Committee on Wednesday morning had Sundar Katwala of British Future, Jonathan Portis, formerly of NYSA, and David Goodhart, another think tanker, talking about immigration and Brexit. And I watched it and I just thought, oh my God, this is so incredibly, incredibly, incredibly complicated. I mean, just, you know, in theoretical situations, like what happens if you have a Polish worker in the Republic of Ireland whose job gets relocated to Northern Ireland, where they will no longer have the automatic right to work. Or, you know, somebody who lives on one side of the border and works on the other side of the border as an EU citizen. The issue of the border in Ireland, particularly if we leave the customs union, is just... a yawning chasm of horror, as far as I can see, particularly at a time when Martin McGuinness, someone with real authority to engage with the peace process, has stepped back from frontline politics. And I'm not sure anybody's really paying attention to that.
No, I mean, I think... So on the upside, as far as the border issue is concerned, everyone, not Downing Street, not the Irish Prime Minister, not Brussels, everyone is reluctant to have a hard border there, and everyone is very keen to protect. However, just because everyone wants to find a way through doesn't mean there necessarily is one, not least because, and one of the things I like about our podcast listeners is this is the only place I can say this without people making what is obviously a crushingly stupid point. Whenever I go, oh, there's a hard border, people go, but there isn't a hard border between Norway and Sweden, right? And there's an EU border. To which I say, I don't know if you've noticed, but neither Norway or Sweden have a constitution set up to mandate power sharing. A border that wouldn't be that hard anywhere else in the world is quite hard indeed if it's between the north and the south. The best solution is probably you have customs checks at ports, the actual coastline, right? So you have one free movement area where basically the government would kind of just concede that he doesn't think immigration is really a problem, right? At least not a problem where you're suddenly going to have thousands and thousands of Poles or whatever coming into the Republic of Ireland, crossing the border and getting on a ferry to Scotland.
Yeah, that was the complexity of it is what I kind of got from it. And you wrote a piece this week about the final settlement of the divorce bill, which put, was it, would you say sort of between 30 and 60 billion in terms of extricating ourselves from obligations that we already have?
Yeah, so there are two sort of areas. One is obviously pension liabilities. The second is things we have agreed to pay for, but we are now leaving before the final bill will come in. Some of that is called the R&L, which is basically payments already made on the idea that the EU will continue to exist in the future. And some of it is sort of simple infrastructure spend. So we've agreed to have some roads built by the EU in various parts of the EU, including in Britain. And we're still going to have to pay for those, even though they will be being built long after we've left. The difficulty with the divorce bill, right, one, because of what's happening to the pound, kind of 40 billion euros is getting bigger all the time in terms of the actual bill than we'll get to the EU. The upper sort of estimation is 60 billion. The lower end is sort of 30. You'd kind of assume you'd end up at 50, 40. To put that in perspective, we spent about 87 billion pounds on education this year. So 60 billion is not a small amount of money. The question is, would that 60 billion be passed as part of the vote on the deal at the end of the process? Would it be paid in instalments? And so every finance bill, the government would have a fight with the Brexiteers on the back benches who'd be saying, we don't want to pay this bill. And obviously, it's a very trivial element of the horror of the Muslim ban. But we've had the government's first go at crisis management this weekend, and a generous marker would give that maybe a D. They're going to have to
downgrade that from a C earlier in the week.
Yeah, I don't really like giving people bad news, but
It was really bad.
But yeah.
One of the things that strikes me about it, and this is an echo of America too, is that kind of Brexit ultras are grumpy and disruptive, and they've been grumpy and disruptive for 5 years. And that means actually, far from what you'd think, you know, they don't get anything because they're not willing to work with other people. They actually end up getting quite a lot. And my interest is in where the sort of loyal block of the Tory party, actually, what reward are they kind of getting for kind of just nodding stuff through that they don't agree with? Obviously, America is a much more extreme example because the Republicans spent 8 years of Obama's presidency just basically blocking every appointment they could, not allowing him to appoint a Supreme Court nominee in the last year of his presidency. I mean, with them, it's a kind of part of an anti-government crusade where they just want to prove that government doesn't work by making it not work. But there is a huge incentive in political systems. It's a kind of prisoner's dilemma, right? That you're either the other side or your own side in this case.
So I was talking about this with one of the Conservative dissidents, and they said, but we know that even if all kind of 40 of that group voted against this, they would be more than replaced by Labour MPs who've been whipped to vote for it. And actually, to be honest,
this is Conservative Remainers, right? If they voted against Article 50.
They kind of feel like when people say that to them, they're basically being asked to go over the top.
Well, let's talk about Jeremy Corbyn in that case and briefly dwell on Labour and what they've done over there. So Jeremy Corbyn has whipped his MPs in favour of voting for it. Emily Thornberry's been out saying, you know, we've got to respect the will of the people. This is a democratic mandate. Keir Starmer looked like, you know, someone had just shot a puppy in front of him. But when he sort of had to say, you know, none of us want to be here, but here we are and we'll vote for it. That, to me, I can see the argument for that. I mean, I've been talking to Harriet Harman this week about her new autobiography. And one of the things that continually comes up is her asking Labour to abstain on the welfare bill in 2015, which is one of the things that is often credited for Jeremy Corbyn winning the Labour leadership election, because of course he wasn't in the cabinet, he was free to vote against at every stage. I think it was a pretty compelling argument that she saw some stuff in the bill that she liked. She wanted to show herself to be not completely hostile to any kind of changes on welfare, because she felt that was out of tune with the country. And there's probably a pretty good argument that Jeremy Corbyn is in that same position as well. But there are strong incentives, aren't there, for Labour MPs in very heavily pro-Remain areas to vote against it.
So I'm going to say something which is going to make me unpopular with precisely 100% of our listeners, which is I sort of think on Article 50 and on the welfare bill, I agree with the case on both instances, right? The welfare bill, Harriet wanted to send a signal that Labour had got it on welfare because she was convinced by the case in their post-mortem of the defeat that that was a problem. And then because she was seen as a grandee with nothing to prove, she could concede on it by abstaining on it, and that would create space for the next Labour leader to not have to do that themselves. Ditto with the Labour leadership now. They look at polling showing them that the referendum vote matters more than the general election vote to most people. Yeah, the PLP is haunted by what happened to Labour's Scottish MPs. And of course, Jeremy never really liked the EU anyway. So it all
kind of... Yeah, for him, it's not a tough decision to trigger Article 50.
And in terms of the Conservative dilemma I was talking about before, the reality is, if the Labour Party was whipping to vote against Article 50, you would still get 50 rebels or in the other direction. So the reality is, in some ways, what Labour does on it is a bit incidental. I think the bigger problem, and what I found immensely annoying about Keir Starmer's, like, oh, we don't want to be here, is one, Labour is not going to get credit for anyone as the party of, oh God, this is awful, but we're going to do it anyway. If Brexit goes well, they're not going to get any credit. If it goes badly, there are many other better natural homes for that impulse. I also think the bigger problem is that Article 50 is the whole of the legislature's last chance to meaningfully limit the executive's power as far as not only Brexit, but the powers that will be repatriated from Brussels will mostly not be repatriated to the legislature. They will be repatriated to the Prime Minister because they are sovereign powers, right? So this is the last chance to go, do you know what? We would quite like Parliament in future to vote on any trade treaties. We are the only legislature in the democratic world that I can think of. If someone can think of an example, it will be very gratefully received, where the legislature does not get to vote on treaties. If they have legal changes, we get to vote on those, but we don't get to amend the treaties or veto the treaties en bloc. We have had no discussion about a divorce bill, and no one really knows what we're going to do as far as Northern Ireland is, whether or not it would be better to leave, you know. So there are two things you need to leave, right? There's the EU and there's the EEA. We joined at the same time, obviously, but they actually have two different leaving articles. One thing you might do is if you triggered Article 50 to leave the EU but didn't trigger Article 127 to leave the EEA, then suddenly the UK's leverage over the EU becomes a lot higher, because obviously the problem with the EEA from a democratic perspective is it's basically the EU rebranded to make it more acceptable to Norway's political class. But if Britain fell out into the EEA, we'd have all of the benefits of EU membership in terms of single market membership. We wouldn't actually be, there would be no separate obligations to pay anything, which suddenly does change the leverage in terms of Britain having a disorderly exit if it can't agree a deal within 2 years' time. There are just huge areas that are not being interrogated at all.
The trouble with that is that I think, to me, being in the EEA sounds very sensible. I mean, I think the EU membership is best still, but, you know, I think that is the least damaging for our financial services industry, for our universities, for all kinds of other things. The trouble is, you know, and I know that Theresa May said we're going out to an EEA with a word that would instantly spring to the lips of her core constituency, who is betrayal.
I also do just think that the EEA is EU membership, right? It's EU.
We could get an exemption on our fish like Norway.
I mean, this thing is, if you're going to stay in the EEA, you're ignoring what people have voted for, so you might as well ignore what people have voted for and stay in the EU.
Well, probably on that anti-democratic note, we should end.
Helen has rushed off to parts unknown, and Julia is on holiday, so it's I and Anoush for this week's Backbencher of the Week. Anoush, who is your Backbencher of the Week?
It has to be Ken Clark, the Tory MP and former Chancellor and Parliament's angriest Europhile. He did a very popular speech in the Article 50 debate in Parliament, slamming the government and his own party. He mocks Theresa May for having this wonderland vision of where she's going to take Britain once she's taken it out of the European Union. And I think he mentioned there being a dormouse. And so he was trying to compare it to Alice in Wonderland, like an impossible world that she'd just dreamed up. And then he also, I think the most damning part of his speech was when he sort of implied that Enoch Powell would have been pleased to see the state of his party now, Eurosceptic. And he also called it anti-immigrant. And that's a really big accusation against your own party. It's also a sign of the times that you can start accusing people of being anti-immigrant and it's not seen as a huge controversy for the people in charge. Maybe being anti-immigrant isn't as much of a taboo as it used to be.
Yeah, which is a troubling thought. I think you're exactly right to identify that. And if you look at the whole of the European right, you know, Mark Rutte with his full page ad being like, if you don't like it, leave.
Yeah.
And that is basically where we are heading.
Exactly. I mean, I always think back to the go home vans. I know they were never actually rolled out, but do you remember, when was it? Was it 2013 or around that time?
2013 was when they had the pilot program.
Yeah. And at that time, as far as I could tell, it was a huge controversy and everyone was saying, you know, this is outrageous. How could you possibly have dreamt up a plan like this? If they brought in such a plan now, I just don't think there would be the same level of outrage or surprise, which is quite distressing. Sorry to bring such a bleak message to your listeners.
It's fine. I mean, usually Backbencher of the Week is always ends up in this fairly grim place. But anyway, we'll be back next week with Dissident of the Week, maybe, the way things are going. Anyway, I'll look after yourselves and we'll see you next week.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
And now for a section called If You Commentate on This, Then Your Children Will Be Next.
Half of the people who weren't listening to last week's podcast won't get that reference, and the other half hate you.
At least three people sent me several suggestions for other Manic Street Preachers songs that I could do. So I think this one could run and run.
Anyway, this is You Ask Us, a section in which you ask us questions.
And the one that people have asked me this week is a Nicola Soames woofed at the SNP MP Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh. I can't even remember the point that he was trying to make, but the question was whether or not this was an instance of sexism in the Commons and whether or not it was overlooked because Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh is an SNP MP. A couple of things. I think probably more than her being an SNP MP, it was overlooked because Nicola Soames is a kind of, he's in the, you know, in the YOLO years being a Tory backbencher, right? My problem is that sexism in the Commons gets traction when it's used as a way to attack people that we don't like, right? So there are some people who, like me, who will always say all sexism is bad. And then mysteriously there are instances of sexism that are a kind of accepted because actually they're a really good way to knock people who don't really, you know, who are opposed to the people who are doing the kind of knocking. So it's just, I think more than her being an SNP MP, it's that it's in no one's interests to brand Nicola Soames a sexist at this point.
Yeah, I mean, so what happened with the woofing, if I recall correctly, is that she was having a go at someone. He kind of woofed, as in, like, you know,
do it.
Yeah,
go on. No. Do like, was it like an arr, or was it like a? Arr?
I can't remember. I mean, it's a terrible place, the House of Commons. But then what happened was is that because he'd already apologised, John Bercow said, "Look, you shouldn't have woofed." But because you've apologised for the woof.
I mean, I don't think you just... Okay, here's my marker where I put down. So I just think generally you shouldn't make animal noises at other adults when you're a grown person in a debating chamber. And one of my problems generally with the way Commons debates, particularly PMQs, goes is that if you've ever been into any school in the land, right, you are not allowed to behave like that. And it must be this really deeply disorientating experience for children to be told, you know, all the time that all these things are terrible things to do, like interrupting other people, bullying them, heck, you know, and then watch our MPs doing it.
Yeah, I also think, and I'm sorry, I imagine for a lot of our listeners, I probably have said this before or you've heard it somewhere else. But as loud as the Commons looks on television in PMQs, it is so much louder in the actual chamber. One of the reasons why in his first couple of PMQs, Jeremy Corbyn had that awful shouty thing, and it was just like, why is he shouting? Is because although the mic can pick you up if you're speaking normally, from your perspective in the chamber, you feel as if you can only be heard if you're shouting, which is why he had those very ranty early performances.
There is a real sense of like who's in the gang, and like, and I think there is a particular thing for new MPs when they arrive that they don't know their way around, and it feels like the first day at your new school turned up to a million, right? Particularly for people who've had, you know, who've worked in like a charity, say, you know, I was talking
or a business, or basically people who just aren't in
people
the
who haven't worked in Inns of Court or haven't been a SPAD or worked in Conservative or Labour central office. I think it can be very weird because it's just no other businesses kind of conduct themselves like that now.
I think the problem is it was overlooked because we've accepted this weird idea and it's okay to behave like a child in the chamber. Lots of MPs hate it. Lots of voters hate it. One of the reasons why I think it was a shame that Jeremy has abandoned his new style of PMQs is I think there was a big tactical win to be had, although obviously I'm willing to accept and seeing as I'm literally the only person in the world who thinks this, probably I'm wrong. A big tactical win by just basically saying, look, everyone hates this. We're not going to have any booing or hollering or whooping or shouting. It's not a football match.
One of the things that's really interesting, though, is that they have gone, they've just completely decided that stuff it, we're going to clap people. Once the kind of clapping dam was broken, right, then actually now they just clap quite regularly.
Yeah, I think it does once again show that force of will can change a lot of these things. I also think in particular, we are about to undergo, hopefully, if Trump doesn't destroy us all before then, undergo a fairly massive change in how the British economy and society works because we leave the EU. And you have a situation in which the people deciding it use these weird codes. They talk about DEXU, i.e. the Brexit department, and oh, brownfield land, oh, austerity, oh, article this, triggering that, my right honourable friend. There has never been a worse time for Parliament to look like this braying, coded bear pit than the massive economic change that is about to hit the country.
Here's some more real talk I'm going to unleash in the safe space of the podcast. The lobby is a huge part of this too. It is incredibly male dominated. I think I can't remember the exact figures, but I think 75%, and certainly among senior political editors, that's even more increased, as with the typical pattern of many high pressure workplaces where plenty of women in their 20s have a crack at it, find it incompatible with family life as they go on. You know, I know plenty of dads actually work in the lobby who find it pretty incompatible with family life. But reading Harriet Harman's book, she talks about Jackie Ashley when she wanted to come back after her having a child and was told that she, by the sergeant arms flatly, that she was not allowed to work part-time. This was not something that you could do. I mean, that was the 1980s and things have changed. The creche might be actually stealthily John Bercow's kind of great legacy to his time as speaker. But it really brought home to me actually when we were talking about the refugee ban, the importance of representation, because actually having Nadim Zahawi, a Conservative MP, saying, I don't think I'm actually going to be allowed into the United States, was a real focal point for that. Having a beloved British athlete like Mo Farah, who might not be allowed into the US states, was a real focal point for that. And it's a very strong argument for why representation matters, because there's a kind of feminist saying, which is, you know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And the strong thing you get throughout the Harman book is very much that, you know, she had to kind of build her squad, and a lot of that she had to build outside Parliament, because actually, you know what, if you're the one person, if you're one of, I think, I can't remember.
Five
female MPs in the Labour Party when she turned up. Her maiden speech is on childcare. And that's not a subject that really bothers anyone else. And yeah, guess what? It's really difficult to get traction.
Yeah,
that.
And I think lots of people will rightly say it's not good enough that the UK government's response to it was, oh, don't worry, we'll get an exemption for our people. However, if the Conservative Parliamentary Party was as undiverse in 2016 as it was in 1987, you know, throughout the past, we wouldn't even have that exemption. It just wouldn't be under discussion, which is why representation always matters. And actually, there is a reason why the Attlee government did lots and lots of things to end working poverty for men, but actually did not significantly change or transform the life of many working women, single mothers, etc., etc. It's because there were hardly any. There was Ellen Wilkinson, and I want to say one other, but I may be inventing a woman, in the Attlee cabinet, right? So even left-wing governments, and we see it with mental health provision, we see it with a whole suite of issues. If you're not represented in the discussion, you get one size fits all solutions, even from left-wing governments. So yeah, representation matters.
Good.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague, Helen Lewis. Why not send us your suggestions for Backbencher of the Week? I'm on Twitter as @StephenKB. She's @HelenLewis. I'm on Facebook at www.facebook.com/StephenKBush. Our music is Devil by the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed by Creative Commons, and our producer is India Bork.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.